And host of Untitled, broadcast Saturdays 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. I'm encouraging you to support listener-sponsored WBAI Radio during our current membership drive. If there ever was a time when we need independent voices to resist and challenge the status quo, that time is here, that time is now. Your financial contribution makes a difference in helping to sustain this vitally important radio station that is WBAI Radio. Thank you.
Hello, people. This is Howard Jordan of the Jordan Journal. And every Friday from 3 to 5 p.m., we will be providing you with the utmost coverage of the issues of the day. Every Friday from 3 to 5 p.m., stay tuned. Listen to the Jordan Journal and don't forget to make a donation to the station. And like I tell you every week, God loves you and I do too.
If you've ever cut your grass and found a car, you might be a redneck.
Did you know that WBAI has a car donation program? Another way to support this station is by donating a vehicle, a car, a truck, RV, or even a boat. To donate a vehicle in support of WBAI, call us at 1-866-WBAI-CAR. That's 1-866-922-4227. WBAI's partners will take all of your information and take care of the details. You can also visit WBAI.org and click on the Ways to Donate banner for more information. Again, that number is 1-866-WBAI-CAR. And then you can leave the lawn ornaments to Foxworthy and friends.
There's nothing on the radio. So maybe that's a cue for me to start the show, isn't it? Yes, yes, I'm back. Deal with it. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, supposed to be weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. Well, I'm out of enchantment and the imagination. I've had the flu, but I've gotten over it. And therefore, David Mack and John Ordover are here. So, we'll make sure they don't get the flu. Join us. Oh, and join us on Facebook Live.
Ogden Persons movie reviewer for Hour of Wolf. The Left Arm Maiden Baptist, Black Panther, the latest installment in Marvel Cinematic Universe, or MCU as we like to call it, is a really good film. Packed with action, amazing visuals, production designer Hannah Beechler weaves naturalistic agriculture into her sets, lining the airship interior with wooden textures and tracing the details.
Okay, high now, those who don't designs. Know, this is the way that Dan Persons actually normally talks, but somehow I failed to fix. I don't know what the bleep is going on there. The player, which is a very good player, is just sort of skipping ahead through it somehow. You know what? There is something amiss. There is something terribly wrong. Okay, so you know what I'm going to do is I am going, since that's a copy, I've got the master on my thumb drive here. It's something else. Sorry. I said I was sick. Okay, so I'm going to play it off of that. And while I'm stalling for that to come up, I will do what I was going to do after that, which is to tell you that the next number one. I was backtracking. I was digressing myself in reverse. I've been gone for 3 weeks. I had a nasty bout of the flu starting actually at the end of January. I'm pretty fully recovered. But as you can, thank you, Danger Will Robinson. Somebody writes on Facebook. Danger Dan Persons, more like it. Well, we'll talk. We may get to Lost in Space. Okay. Thank you, Ken Gale, for filling in for 3 weeks while I was out. Fabulous stuff that he had here, including having Mark Hamill as a guest. That'll do. Yeah. Talking mostly about his voiceover work and stuff like that. Yes, Mark can see that, you know. Mark can see that. So thank you, Ken Gale, for filling in. You did great radio while I was gone. Okay, the next New York Review of Science Fiction reading will be March 6th, a week from next Tuesday. And we have two really spiffy, wonderful writers, Nicholas Kaufman, who has been around for a long time and read at many, many places, and yet, for reasons unknown, other than I can say mea culpa, has not yet ever been at a Nursif reading. Yes, David, let me open your mic, and now you can talk.
Do you know that today is Nick Kaufman's birthday?
Was.
Was. It, yeah, we've passed
midnight. Well, actually, if you're listening in California...
It still is. I just wanted to get that out there and say happy birthday to my friend Nick. I'm sorry I was not able to join you today for lunch, but I do wish you the happiest of birthdays.
Absolutely. And since this is the last birthday he will have before he is in L. Mm. That's the Roman numeral, L.
Mm.
And so the two things that I learned about that from the late Simon Locley was, one is that when you turn that age, you say, welcome to L.
Ah.
And you can always begin every conversation when you want to make a point, and God knows Nicholas is one of us, and therefore always wanting to make a point, will say things like, you know, for the better part of a century, I've always believed. So that's the big advantage of that. But today, you are a man. Today, you are 49. And congratulations and most happy birthday. Nicholas Kaufman, who we're talking about, is the Bram Stoker Award nominated, Thriller Award nominated, and Shirley Jackson Award nominated. You know, when you read this out loud, Nick, it's not as good. Author, but this is for print, author of numerous novels in the horror, fantasy, and adventure genres. His short fiction has appeared in Cemetery Dance, Dark Discoveries, X, The Erotic Treasury, All-American Horror of the 21st Century, and others. In addition to his own original work, he has written for such properties as Zombies vs. Robots and The Rocketeer. He lives in Brooklyn, where you can actually hear the cars going by on Atlantic Avenue right now, live on the air, with his wife Alexa and two ridiculous cats. Oh, God, I really hope he doesn't have a dot. when he speaks to his wife, because it'll just start ordering books and mailing them to his house. I have both an Alexa and a Dot. And a Google Mini.
Yeah, I don't have ridiculous cats. I have a derpy cat and I have a bitchy cat.
Ooh, okay. Most cats are bitchy.
This one takes it to a whole new level. She is the princess of kitty bitches.
Now, our other reader, actually it's the first time reading her own work at a New York Sif reading, but her second appearance, Elisa Quitney.
I'm not familiar with the name. Please tell me more.
Okay. She also writes under the name Elisa Sheckley.
Still don't know the name.
I do.
Explain, John.
I assume she is Robert Sheckley's daughter or something of that nature. Robert Sheckley.
She is Robert Sheckley's daughter.
Right.
And the daughter of Ziva Quitney. And for various reasons having to do with the... I think Ziva was the third out of five.
I just realized that would be a hit book title, The Science Fiction Author's Daughter.
Ooh. That's a speculative.
It's waiting to happen.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And if anybody takes it, you're going to have David to speak to.
Sadly, you cannot copyright a title. I've learned this the hard way so many times.
Yeah. Elisa Quitney, who also writes under the name Elisa Sheckley, is the Eisner. Now, you see, you should know her. Is the Eisner. Will Eisner, everybody, you know, get the spirit. Nominated author of numerous graphic novels, prose novels, and nonfiction titles. She was an editor at DC Comics Vertigo and has an MFA in fiction from Columbia University. The first issue of her DC Prestige miniseries, Mystic U, was named one of the 15 best comics of 2017 by IO9, and the School Library Journal said her recent novel, Cadaver and Queen, was highly recommended, adding this steambuck play on Frankenstein set in the English countryside against the backdrop of the Boer War. That old trope again explores themes of belonging, sexuality, and what it means to be human. She lives in Rhinebeck, New York, but is still an Upper West Sider at heart. It doesn't mention that among the comics she wrote, three of them were called Sandman.
Color me mortified.
Yeah, and she is currently working on... Well, doing background research on a novel.
I see.
In which...
I share her pain.
She's finding gods. Mm-hmm. It's a sequel. That's all I'll say.
All right, then.
But figure it out from Sandman and extrapolate from there. Well, actually, she's the first person named in the book Norse Mythologies.
Is that the Gaiman Project?
Everything I've named is Neil Gaiman.
I see.
But she didn't put it in the bio, so I didn't say anything.
Well, there you are.
So I was... But, you know...
I feel like I'm on NPR.
I think that she was the editor of some of the Sandman books, and therefore co-authored three of the graphic novels. And she helped... She not only helped work, but she helped propel the Norse mythology book. And she is doing research on American Gods, too.
Ah.
Which I'm not sure if this is the... They're turning stuff now into graphic novels. I'm not sure if it's coming out first as prose, which is what I would prefer, or as a graphic novel. I'm interested in seeing the graphic novel of the book.
Interesting, yes.
Of the first book, which is currently being worked on.
Yes.
But the...
With covers by my namesake.
Yes, we're going to have to talk about that.
I feared we would.
Yes, well, yeah, our guest tonight is our David Allen Mack.
But I go by David Mack professionally, except in comic books.
But you are not involved in sports.
No, I'm not. Nor am I involved in Middle East politics.
Right.
Or in British antiques.
Right.
Am I a corrupt police officer from the L.A. Ramparts Division.
Oh, I saw that one.
Which is actually going to be a miniseries pretty soon.
And then, oh.
Yeah, they're doing the whole
what American Justice kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, the same guys who did the OJ thing. I think they're doing the whole killing of Biggie Smalls.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm prepared for like a whole new round of questions from my fans after that airs.
Okay, can you get a part in it or something?
I think it's already filmed. I'm pretty sure it's already in.
Help write the damn thing?
No, I think that's probably water under the bridge.
Okay, hello, Christine. I'm talking, of course, to people who. Has anybody here, somebody saying Joel, met Murray Leinster's daughter? It's not Leinster, it's Leinster, I discover. And yes, I've had Billy Stallings on my show. So I've met her. She is, Michael Swanwick brings her around occasionally to conventions. She is a charming person. She wrote a biography of her father, whose name, of course, was Will Jenkins. But he wrote under the name, I always assumed it was Murray Leinster, but he took the name from Leinster County. Hmm. You don't know the name Murray Leinster?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Read a story from 1947 from Astounding Tales called A Logic Named Joe. And you'll basically understand that he invented the iPhone.
Wow.
In 1947.
And he also wrote the story First Contact that gave a name to that whole genre of First Contact stories.
And wow, he also wrote
that's an achievement.
He also wrote a novel called The Time Tunnel.
I think
somebody took that idea and turned it into a TV series.
Probably.
For which he never got paid.
Isn't that always the way?
Yes. So, yes, I certainly do know Murray Leinster's daughter. She is, I have to have her on the air again. She knows how to Skype.
That'll be the sequel to my hit. That'll be the other sci-fi author's daughter.
Or maybe it's the sci-fi author's daughters.
Oh.
And they solve crimes.
Well,
now we're getting somewhere. We have a whole paradigm.
Well, so Cordwainer Smith's two daughters come in next.
Sure.
And we'll stay away from the Shirley Jackson monsters.
And didn't I at one point in college know the niece of Ursula Le Guin?
Yes.
So
you both did.
Was she the niece or?
Well, cousin. I grew up with Ursula's brother's family.
I'm just trying to figure out what is her relation to Ursula. Was she a niece?
She still is. Ursula passed away, but yes.
Well, yes.
Yes, she was visiting
remains the niece.
She was visiting me.
So that's not a sci-fi author's daughter per se, but could definitely fit into the narrative.
Oh, come on. She's in the immediate family.
Sure.
Lifestyles of the relatives of the science fiction writers.
Okay. Oh, in the meantime.
Lifestyles of the relatively famous?
Yes.
Okay. Dan, we're going to try this again, this time from the flash drive. And this should work better. Ooh,
If it plays at an accelerated rate, this is basically Jim's punishment for running overtime.
Yes, indeed.
Dan's punishment, but yes.
It's Jim inflicting the punishment upon Dan. So is the punishment the property of Dan, or is the punishment the property of he who inflicts it?
He's running overtime because he missed two shows because I was out sick. So he's had to compress everything into other episodes, you see. So that was actually on me. But let's hope this works because it is au courant, and I did advertise it. So let us try that again and see if Dan is here. Otherwise, we have to push it to next week, but I hope not.
One person's movie reviewer for Hour of
Wolf. Oh, dear. Dan, my deepest apologies. I do not know what happened to the copy that I made from. Ooh, I can still get it. I can still get this because he mailed it to me online.
So we're going to.
We're going to play it later in the show.
Maybe we should cut to some music while you.
No.
Gather, or no. We shouldn't.
No. Why don't we start talking? Why don't
or we
start...
could do that too.
Yes, because I just need to finish.
Just thought that there might be profanity involved during the download process, for which we might wish to be.
There usually is, but
yes. I was only thinking of you, Jim.
Bleep, no. But anyway, let us introduce our guests. One of them is all too well known to regular listeners of Hour of the Wolf, or Poisoned Arts, for that matter, more as a instigator than anything else, John Ordover, who was the landlord to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings for, what, about 3 years?
It seemed so much longer, but yes, about 3 years.
About 3.5 years, I think. And I did the soft launch, as it were, because the very first event in your art gallery was an event that I put together.
Yeah.
And John, of course, was heavily, heavily involved in not only the Star Trek books, being an editor at Pocket, and also at Tor.
I went from Tor to Pocket.
Right, you went from Tor to Pocket. And then, yeah, the mnemonic there is Tor the Pocket. And the whatever works for a mnemonic is good enough.
Whatever gets you there.
And with David Mack, not, this one not being the artist, but the one who is with us today, wrote a script, which, thanks to John's connections at Star Trek, they were able to pitch. That did not sell, but your second one
That's
did.
Not quite right, but you okay, were very close, it. And we'll give you points for the effort.
Okay, yeah. Tell it correctly, then.
All right, the short version was that I had been pitching stories and sending in spec scripts to Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine for many years, collecting many rejections. I had gone to NYU Film School, so I had the technical chops to write a script, but I did not have the business connections or the relationships to get a pitch meeting with the producers. John,
did.
At the time, was the senior editor of Star Trek Fiction at Pocket Books. He was in a position to get such a meeting. However, he did not have professional training in screenplays, and though he saw them every week, was not necessarily certain that he could execute one on his own. But you put the two of us together, my skill set plus his access and his skill set, with me as the primary draft writer and John as the editor finding the weaknesses and helping me fix the scripts. Together, we were able to come up with a number of good ideas. We convinced ourselves, or I should say, we assured ourselves that we were capable of doing the job professionally. And then John got us the meeting by phone, first with Voyager, where we made a sale on our first phone call.
Voyager. I always call it V'ger.
We don't.
Yes.
Yeah, because that movie sucks.
They paid us.
By the way, Dan,
I think it's underrated, but we'll go into that another time.
Oh, yeah.
But the story was that on our first...
One second. Immediate business. Dan, I need to use the one from yesterday, from the 20th, correct? I believe that's the second one you sent. Okay, no, I think I'm looking at the wrong one. No, seriously.
I'm just trying to keep you from having dead air.
Oh, okay, no, I'm talking to somebody.
I know you're talking to somebody, but to the mass of people out there listening at the other end of the radio.
Okay, you're playing Jeopardy, okay.
Yeah, I'm just trying to keep, okay, you know, keep the thing going.
Yeah, I have to figure out whether he needs to resend
the train,
the file to me or not. I found it. It's the one for the 21st. Okay, here we are. And there we go. Yes, I agree. I don't have to go through all this nonsense when I am at home. And no, I've got it, Dan. Thank you. David, you may continue about pitching.
So, off of our first phone call with Star Trek Voyager, we made a story sale, I believe, to Jerry Taylor.
That's correct.
And off of the strength of that sale, we sent her one of the spec scripts that we had worked on together, which was for Deep Space Nine. Now, although she could not have looked at a spec script for her own show, she could look at one for DS9. And we sent it as a calling card to say, this is what we're capable of. She liked it enough that when she heard about a week or two later through the grapevine that we had made another story sale on our first phone call with Deep Space Nine's producers, including Ira Bear, she walked our spec script downstairs, to Ira Bear said, I heard you bought a story from Mac and Ordover. He said, yes, we did. And she said, well, I think you should read their spec script. It's really good, and I think that you might want to give these boys a script assignment. He read our spec script, which technically he shouldn't have since it was a DS9 script, but he did it on Jerry's recommendation, and he agreed with her, and as a result, we had the privilege of being first-time sales, you know, our first sale to television, our first Hollywood sale. We ended up getting the script assignment, which means we got to go out to LA, we got to be in the room for the break session, where they take the story outline and they break it into act and scene by scene, and here are all the breaks. And then they said, okay, you take this, you got 2 weeks, turn in a draft. And it was, a lot of it was just because we had taken the time, John and I, to practice to make sure that we were a good team working together and that we had confidence in our abilities. But it also is, we owe a lot to Jerry Taylor, who liked our work and vouched for us, to Ira Stephen Bear, and to Ira Stephen Bear, who took a chance on us when he didn't have to. And I'm proud to say that a few months back at Star Trek Las Vegas, I was able to catch up with Ira Stephen Bear for the first time since that episode aired. And I was able to thank him in person for buying that script from us and effectively launching my writing career.
Now,
it was actually, we turned out, we, it was good that we practiced.
John, point the mic more at yourself.
Okay. It turned out that Dave and I worked very well together because I loathe first drafts, but like revising, and Dave hates being interfered with while he's doing his first draft. So that worked out perfectly.
Okay, and I'd like to get a first draft into this room. It's bleeping hot in here.
It's warm. It's close.
Yeah, it really is. It smells of BAI. Okay.
That's what that is.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yes. I thought maybe we were ripening cheese.
No, no. It's, you can tell that the smells are all to the left. But anyway. Yes.
Rich.
Okay. So we are actually ready with our review now.
I'm looking forward to hearing it after all this buildup.
Yeah. And just remind people. Thank you, Daniel, for your technical support over Facebook, and let people know that if you'd like to watch what this is that we are doing and see the behind the scenes stuff, you can go to, I think you have to go to my timeline on Facebook, and you'll see the video running there, and you can join us, and you can even chat at us, although Why
would you want to do such a thing?
It's really a good question. In the meantime, I understand that a movie opened a while ago, which is a bit of a marvel. So, but Dan's actually reviewing not only that, but something else that I'm planning to see within the week. The Oscar-nominated animated shorts. Mm. Although sometimes they wear long pants. Never mind. Let's turn this over to Dan now. We'll be back in 10 minutes.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date February 22nd, 2018, Black Panther.
This means you get the unedited version. That's why it's take three. They're small.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. So let's not make any bones about this. Black Panther, the latest installment in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or MCU as we like to call it, is a really good film. Packed with action, amazing visuals, production designer Hannah Beechler weaves naturalistic African culture into her sets, lining an airship interior with wooden textures and tracing the details of a high-tech laboratory with colorful tapestry designs, and marked notably by strong performances from a largely black cast, led by a graceful, charismatic performance by Chadwick Boseman as T'Challa, the newly crowned king of the futuristic kingdom of Wakanda and, just incidentally, the titular Black Panther. There's a little weirdness in how the spirituality ingrained in this particular corner of the universe reconciles with the rest of the MCU, We've already discovered that the gods of Norse mythology are real entities. Now, in this film, several characters visit a spirit plane for conversations with their ancestors, and while the film plays cagey in saying whether this is an actual place one can go to, or just a character's hallucination, there are intimations that, yeah, we're supposed to accept this as real. But aside from the impending confusion with that, and somebody is going to have to come up with a unified spirituality theory for the MCU if it hasn't been done already, Black Panther can take its place at the side of the best of Disney's Marvel movies. Which is kind of a problem. Just on the level of the entire franchise, as impressive as Black Panther is, we are getting used to this level of quality from an MCU film. Things that should amaze, from ceremonial battles set in a stunningly CG-realized cliffside amphitheater to full-on warfare with martial arts, aerial combat with futuristic aircraft, rampaging armored rhinos, and two Black Panthers battling it out for control of the kingdom, just get slotted into the stuff we expect from big Marvel films. That would be problem enough. But this isn't just any Marvel movie. This is the long-awaited Black Panther. One would hope, given the state of our nation as it stands, and the fact that this was directed by Ryan Coogler, whose previous credits include Fruitvale Station and Creed, that the opportunity would have been taken to bring a deeper social relevance to the proceedings. Coogler does drop hints around the edges, mostly through the voice of T'Challa's rival for the throne, Killmonger, played by Michael B. Jordan, and I wouldn't be surprised to hear that the director had to fight like hell to get what little is implied into the film. But what little is raised is also quickly shunted aside, and it may as well be Thor and Loki fighting for mythical primacy as two men whose fictional conflict might have compelling relevance in the real world. Frankly, X-Men has done more to address issues of equality and how it should be attained than Black Panther dares. On the one hand, I can understand the reluctance. There's always a risk in hitching superheroes too tightly to the problems of the real world, where there isn't a Wakandan technological paradise to solve all or many of our woes. The irony is that a major theme in Black Panther is whether one should engage with the world at the risk of corruption or hide from it and maintain integrity, with, spoiler alert, T'Challa within the film finally deciding on the former, while the suits at Disney have clearly decided for the movie, ooh, maybe not this time. Just be happy we're doing Black Panther at all, okay? But Black Panther is now a mammoth hit, and hopefully, with Wonder Woman, we can finally put to rest the notion that the protagonists of tentpole superhero blockbusters have to be white and male. Maybe that will embolden Disney to be a bit more daring in their messaging in the inevitable sequel. That's a big if, as the delay in getting the Black Panther character to the screen has proven, it takes a lot of effort to get the lumbering corporate behemoth to change direction. But I'm not looking for a manifesto here. These are supposed to be fun films, after all. A point that's apparently lost on Zack Snyder over that other cinematic universe. I just would like something that would make this specific franchise more than just a really swell time in the MCU. At this point, this is a universe that needs that kind of jolt. And today, Thursday, February 22nd, is the last day that you can catch the Oscar-nominated animated shorts at the IFC Center in New York, although it is available on shorts.tv/theoscarshorts if you miss it there. If you're into animation, it is worth getting to. There's not a dud in this particular bunch. Although Dear Basketball, Kobe Bryant's self-penned valedictory to the sport he loves, the only traditional 2D animated entry in the lot, directed by the legendary Glenn Keane and scored by none other than John Williams, does leave you waiting for a Nike swoosh or Gatorade logo that never arrives, which may say more about the high quality of animated commercials these days than about whatever is lacking in this short. Pixar is represented by Lou, about a schoolyard bully who gets his comeuppance from the anthropomorphized contents of a lost and found bin. Pixar shorts tend to be demos of new animation techniques. In this case, the company has been highlighting the mutability of the bully's adversary, how the arms of a sports jersey at one point function as legs, then turn into stalks supporting a pair of tennis ball eyes. What's as notable, though, is how, Pixar being Pixar, the bully from the get-go is still kind of lovable, which raises the stakes effectively for his redemption at the end. Revolting Rhymes is the longest film in the bunch, a CG animated adaptation of nursery rhyme satires penned by Roald Dahl and adapted by the same people who did the rather draggy Room on the Broom a few years ago. This is much better, cleverly weaving the stories of several characters, notably Little Red Riding Hood and Snow White, together, and even intimating that the relationship between Riding Hood and Snow White may be a little more than a friendship. For all the wit, though, there's nothing particularly standout in the animation, and in the effort to build a continuity around these individual tales, some of Dahl's adult edge has been lost. The adaptation to a visual medium also appears to have altered the context of Negative Space, a stop-motion animated film in which the narrator reflects upon bonding with his father over the parent's very precise technique for packing a suitcase. Based on a possibly autobiographical poem by Ron Corce, I hope I'm getting that name right, while the words leave some ambiguity about the relationship between parent and child, the visuals, alternating between the inanimate objects that form the suitcase's contents and directors Max Porter's and Ron Kuwahata's bulbous, rough-honed stop-motion figures looking like light bulbs and clothing, leave no doubt. The title, Negative Space, reflected as much in a child, captured small and isolated in his home, awaiting the reassuring phone call of his frequently absent father, as in the dread pointlessness of an empty suitcase. The film that I feel should win, and that probably will not, is Garden Party, a CG animated short about a group of taciturn, mildly anthropomorphized frogs who wander the exterior and interior of a mansion where something very, very bad has recently happened. This is actually a student project out of France's MoPA Animation School, technically impressive for the photorealism of the characters and the backgrounds, and downright awesome for how the character's slow tour of the disaster area builds in a deliberate, pitch-black comedic way, one morbidly obese toad lapping up the decaying remains of a lavish banquet, another repeatedly slamming against a window in pursuit of an insect, its muted thud from without, serving as punctuation to the self-involved adventures of the companions within. This is dark, brilliant stuff that builds to a suitably wicked punchline. Even if it doesn't win, Garden Party is worth seeing. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons. Hashtag ITMFA.
Thank you, Dan. Well, I'm very glad that we got that on there. I'll have to listen to it when I got home because, of course, anybody watching on Facebook knows we were talking about anything but Black Panther. We were talking about Free Jack. We were talking about the Siodmak brothers.
My favorite science fiction trivia, apparently. I asked question. The Queen of Calafia is a character in what speculative fiction book, and when was it published? And if I'll answer it later on Facebook.
I don't know. Well, I mean, Facebook
and
is there
all
now.
We reeled in amazement at your abilities, John.
Yeah. Somebody asking about Harlequin, because I love you, Daddy-O, says Dan Persons. You know Dan, don't you?
I don't know that we've met, or if we have, I'm John? Afraid the encounter has...
Of course I do.
Yeah, of course you do, because you were on...
Well, no,
TV.
I've known him from the convention circuit and around science fiction world for years. We've also been on the show together.
Yeah, exactly.
Live in person.
Yes.
I don't know that Dan and I have ever met.
Okay, yeah. Dan, for years, edited Cine Fantastique, which was one of the best magazines.
I knew it was a magazine.
Yeah, yes. He edited that magazine.
Yes.
was a chief writer for it, and now does, you know, is still doing stuff for John Drew, and for me as movie reviewer, John Drew, of course, of the famous television program,
The Chronic Rift.
The Chronic Rift, which I was on, I think, 3 times.
I was on it. I think I was just on it once.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought you were on it more than that.
No, I think just the one time. Maybe I did. It all blends together after a while.
Well, the horrifying thing is they've been putting them up on YouTube.
I know. So I've seen them.
It's, oh, God.
You should have seen the episode where Keith was one of the guests and so with Catherine Kramer, and he spent the entire episode staring down her shirt.
And that's different from the modern day. Because
nothing. That's Keith all over.
Yes. That's how you remember how to say Keith's last name. DeCandido. D, he likes D-cups. Candid, he's very candid about liking D-cups. Oh, did we mention that Keith likes D-cups?
We are, of course, referring to Keurig coffee. This is Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. Our guests this morning are David Mack and John Ordover, who have collaborated possibly way too much on...
Or not enough, or perhaps just the right amount.
Yeah, well, it depends on when you sell the movie version of the science fiction daughters.
Yeah. Science fiction writer's daughter.
Please tell me I'm not sharing that with you.
An Attack of the Classics in Philly.
I'll take credit for the title, whether you like it or not.
Of course you will.
Yeah, Dan, you'll have to explain that sometime. Dan, also, you and I have to talk off-air about what we're going to be doing in April, which is the 50th anniversary of... Oh, come on. Okay, let's try a simple one.
What did I just get?
What's the best science fiction film of all time?
Galaxy Quest.
He got it.
All right. It's the 50th anniversary
of Galaxy Quest.
I feel like I missed a...
It's called 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yes.
Oh, I see.
You know, actually...
It's a little slow.
The interesting thing is that Dave and I have individual book projects.
That's very exciting. Actually, we haven't worked together
in 20 years.
Oh, it's not that long. 17.
Oh, 17 years. It feels longer.
Yeah. More mostly because we wish it was longer.
Yeah.
Okay. Now David has just launched a new book project.
I have. The Dark Art series is my new labor of love, now out from Tor. The first book is The Midnight Front. It's a World War II era dark fantasy war epic. It's secret history, not alt history, so I'm obligated to respect the outcome of major events of the war. I don't kill off any personas who were known to have lived through it, for instance. But it's basically the story of one man, a young American, studying at Oxford. He and his parents try to evacuate England at the start of the war. The Nazis sink the ship. They run for the lifeboats, and a demon comes out of the water, eats the lifeboats, eats his parents.
Again?
Yes. Yes, it's this classic trope. And then he is rescued by, and for those of you on Facebook Live who see me gesturing to the book cover, he is rescued by the last surviving members of the Midnight Front.
Hold the book up. Yeah, good, very good.
He is rescued by the last surviving members of the Midnight Front, which is the Allies' top secret black magic warfare program. And he joins with them. He learns the ways of black magic, in which all magic is predicated on the conjuring and control of demons. And if you get it wrong, they kill you. And he undertakes a mission of revenge, and over the course of the war, he eventually learns that the real meaning of heroism lies not in revenge, but in sacrifice.
Now, you see, now I know exactly who to pair you with for an year's of reading.
That's encouraging to know.
Yeah, one of two people, either Mike Cole.
Please no.
Or Tom Doyle.
Yes.
Tom Doyle it is.
Very good.
Okay.
Now, the fun thing about the Dark Art series, although the first book is set in World War II...
And let me just explain to people, soldiers and magic.
Yes. I would say that the American Craftsman series is a little closer in terms of concept to...
And Tom's a good friend.
And Tom's a friend of mine. I like Tom very much. And Tom was very helpful to me in promoting this and very very much in my corner, as they would say, encouraging me with it.
Oh, good.
We met a number of years ago.
He's a lovely person.
He is. He's a wonderful guy. And both to our authors.
He also, he was the last person to read when the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings was in John's domicile.
Oh, yes, the Soho Gallery of Digital Art.
Which no longer exists.
Which is very sad, but there you go.
Yeah. Anyway, well, it really didn't exist then. That was the basement.
Just want to finish the quick sales pitch here. So although the first book is a war epic in World War II, I didn't want to just have this be another war story after war story. So the premise of Dark Arts is that each successive book in the series jumps to a different geopolitical era of 20th century history, and is also a different style of novel. So the second book in the series, which is already written, is called The Iron Codex. That's set in 1954, and it's a Cold War spy thriller.
Ooh!
The third book, which I'm in the middle of plotting and working out the story right now with my editor, is called The Shadow Commission, and that's set in 1963 and will take place over the period of 1 week following the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963. And it's a conspiracy paranoia piece. So the idea is that with this book
this
series...
This is WBAI. We call that documentary.
I see. So the idea is that with each book in the series reinvents itself, that each book is a different reading experience with a different structure, a different style, a different pace. And
probably standalones. I mean, yes, not that one shouldn't start.
Although there is a consistent core cast of characters that will carry through the series with their aging slowed thanks to black magic. The premise is that we jump to these different eras and through this continuing group of characters experience different eras of world and American history. We get to get new perspectives on events that we thought we knew. But also the readers just get a different reading experience with each book. So they're not just reading World War II followed by Korean War followed by Vietnam War.
You just answered because I was wondering where the second book took place.
The second book, as I said, is a Cold War spy thriller. It's very much in that sort of early
But that could
James
put it
Bond.
In Berlin or...
Let's just say that it involves... nuclear devices and the Cold War struggle to control that
So closer
technology.
To Bond than to Le Carré.
Yes, I would think that is a fair approximation. And then book three, I think, has sort of a dramatic heritage that could be traced back to 3 Days of the Condor, let's say.
Okay, right.
It's very much a paranoia conspiracy piece. And the idea is that if the books sell well enough that we continue beyond book three, as my editor and I are both hoping... The concept for book four would be a 1970s era crime thriller set in New York with multiple warring gang factions, organized crime, etc. Book five could be a corporate heist piece set in the 80s. And then book six could be set in the 90s, and it could be anywhere from the Balkanized states of Eastern Europe to the aftermath of the Soviet incursion in Afghanistan.
I like the Falkland Islands.
Or the Falkland Islands, if one wanted to go there and get into the whole Pink Floyd Final Cut.
Yes, exactly.
Which was one of my all-time favorite albums, by the way. So, yeah, but the idea is that the series
you
reinvents itself
Tom
with every
Stoppard
book.
On that.
Yes. So the idea is the series reinvents itself with every book, and this way I as an author, don't get bored, and my readers get to have a different experience with every book in the series.
Yeah, and this is very different from the types of books that you've written in the past.
Yes, a lot of my work in the past has been media tie-in fiction.
Mm-hmm. Work
for Hire is the way it's normally
contracted.
Contracted. Yeah. There is, based from contract to contract, different agreements regarding royalties, credit, etc. But I guess you could term it all work for hire. But it all falls under the license or under the catch-all term media tie-ins.
Yeah.
And I've done work for everything from Star Trek, which is the bulk of my resume, 27 novels and counting. I've also worked for...
Is that the record?
No, far from it. In fact, I'm in third place.
Let me guess. Greg Cox?
Nope. Greg is actually behind me in Ooh. Total Star Trek novels. He's very close on my heels, but he is so diversified. He's so much in demand by other licenses that he doesn't have the same sort of singular focus on Star Trek that I've had over the last 16 years. Mm. I think he's in the low 20s, so he's nipping at my heels, along with Dayton Ward. I'm at 27, and above me there is only Michael Jan Friedman in place number 2 with 35 full-length novels.
And at number 1...
Peter David, 45 full-length Star Trek novels.
You see, I should have guessed that.
Now, take into account that I am not counting novellas, I'm not counting short stories, right. I'm not counting comic book stories. I'm only counting
bound titles,
full-length novels, you know, 40,000 words or more, published as a novel, etc. By that criteria, Peter has 45, Michael Jan Friedman has 36, I have 27, putting me in third place. One of these days, I am soon to be dislodged, I'm sure, by Dayton Ward.
At the risk of not knowing what the bleep I'm talking about, you two collaborated on a cycle, a Star Trek cycle of...
A Star Trek comic book miniseries.
Yes. Yes, that's just
Divided
been released,
We Fall.
Divided We Fall, which has just been released in hardcover.
Right.
Thanks to the folks at Eagle Moss Publishing.
Yes.
A British...
Eagle Mouse?
Eagle Moss.
Okay.
As in a rolling eagle gathers no...
No moss. Okay. Moss.
Yes. Eagle Moss Collections, which is a British-based company. They're known mostly for doing Starship miniatures, but they've also been doing, through their publishing division... collected editions of various Star Trek graphic novels, and volume 22 of their ongoing collected edition series is devoted to Divided We Fall, a four-issue miniseries that John and I wrote together in 2001, and which was published during the summer of 2001. In fact, the last issue of it, the concluding issue, was published just before the 9/11 attacks.
And, it's really nice to finally... Up till now, it was the only miniseries that had not been collected from the Wildstorm era.
Yes, in any format.
Except German.
Yes, essentially all of the other Wildstorm miniseries that had been published had received trade paperback collected editions in English. Ours received no such treatment for no explanation that we were ever given. However, it did have a German language trade paperback edition, of which I have a copy. It's very nice. I can't read it, but I know the story already, so that's fine.
Speaking of
getting
copies of things, if Eagle Moss is if Eagle Moss is listening, Dave has gotten his author copy, but I'd kind of like mine.
We had a bit of a bungle. You see, once I realized that the collected edition had actually been published, I contacted a friend of mine, Ben Robinson, who works at Eagle Moss, and I said, Ben, John and I, this was our first published work together in comics, and I would really appreciate it if you could send a few copies to me and a few copies to John. And I gave him my mailing address, I gave him John's mailing address, and I was hoping this would be a pleasant surprise for John to receive a few hardcover copies of our work. And we were waiting and waiting, and there were numerous screw-ups with the DHL delivery due to human error on the shipping of the parcel. And I finally received mine several days late, and I discovered only then, when I had followed up with my contact at Eagle Moss, that in their publishing office, they had had only the one lone copy, which they sent to me.
Oh, my.
And they had told me, like I had said, you know, I had said very specifically, can you send me a few copies and send John a few copies? And they had told me they would take care of it. And then suddenly they had sent one to me, claimed they were out. So I now have one hardcover copy of this wonderful comic book miniseries that John and I did, which I'm still very proud of. I thought we did excellent work on it. John, sadly, does not have a copy of it because Eagle Moss apparently did not see fit to stock more than one copy in their corporate home office in London. So, Eagle Moss, if you could please requisition a few extra copies of the book and ship a few to John, it would warm the cockles of our cynical New Yorker hearts. Please.
And
you heard it here, folks.
Yes.
If any eagles are gathering moss... and
then roll them with the stones.
Exactly.
And get them over here.
Yeah. Yes.
Get them stoned, roll them, and get copies of our book from them.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, everybody listening to this should, you know,
rush out and buy it.
Absolutely.
There are links, if you were to Google Divided We Fall, Star Trek, Mac, Ordover, Eagle Moss, you would find this wonderful hardcover edition, and you should buy it.
Well, yeah, but if somebody wanted that or The Midnight Front published by Tor...
You could go to my website, for instance.
And that would be what?
David Mack, M-A-C-K, .pro, P-R-O.
And be careful. Now we're in
trouble.
From
davidmack.pro, you can go to the menu. There's a thing that says his work.
Excuse me, that person who just started watching, do you want to phone in... At 347-335-0818, unless I would wake Ren.
Oh, no. No. Oh, no. This is going to go badly.
Keith is calling in?
I think so.
No. This is somebody named Thrush who lives next door to a wren.
Oh, okay.
Or simulates that.
I think this still bodes ill.
So, Jim, if I may, speaking of books
There's this other great book.
You're safe, by the way.
Yeah.
He says, nah, I'm good.
All right, then.
We know that you're good, Keith. The question was if you're going to talk on the radio. Yeah. I see.
We know your level of quality. We'll put it that way.
I was being nice.
I wasn't.
So for those of you watching on Facebook, I'm holding up the cover of John's book.
Lie There and Lose Weight, How I Lost 100 Pounds by Doing Next to Nothing.
And by the way, there has
never been a more John book title in the history of book titles.
Yeah, there really is. But for those people who have known John through the years, there was a lot of head shaking about he's got to do something to like lose 100 pounds. And then lo and behold.
Well, I was never going to cast that stone.
No.
I did. John will recall.
Yes.
And while he was hawking me about smoking.
Right.
At the same time. Mm-hmm. So this is all quite a few years ago. But then John lost the weight over a period of time, which is to say he did it healthy.
He did it slowly, with a manageable lifestyle.
Yes, exactly.
And through controlling your portions.
And hating every minute of it.
Oh, yeah.
But I
admire the fortitude that it must have taken you to do that.
And yeah. I kept it off.
And by the way,
now.
We need to tell people, we're not going to get into this at length. But we should let people know this is not a diet. This is about the diet that you're on.
It's basically a book about how to stick to whatever diet has worked for you. And that, I think, it's basically the companion piece to every other diet book. The last thing the world needs is another person telling you the new miracle diet. My book is, there is no miracle. It's very hard. I have a couple of tricks that might make it easier. But I'm not telling you how to do a darn thing.
I'm
telling you how to succeed at whatever you're doing.
We might even do something about that on air, because I find that conversation, which we're not going to take too far right now.
I'm just going to say that as the guy that had to get him into his tux for his wedding, on his wedding day, as the guy who was the MC of John's wedding, and I had to make sure that he didn't go spring, and his cummerbund didn't go fup, 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 in his face.
So you're the reason my pants were falling down all evening.
Well, it's because you didn't help. I was trying to give you clear instructions, anyway, but the point is...
Okay, let's not go near the pants falling down.
We're
going to
let that go. Yeah. I'm just going to say that as
otherwise
someone who has been there during...
Me Too badges, no.
As someone who has been there during John's bad times, we'll say, I'm very impressed that he found a way to...
He found a healthful
way to discipline himself into controlling portions, controlling calorie counts, and to overcome the feelings of despair and whatever that go with that process. And he powered through it through force of will, and he is in far better condition than I've ever seen him in the many years, like the 25 years we've known each other. He looks great. He's accomplished a lot. And he deserves all the accolades that he gets, because he did it through force of will, and he did it without sacrificing his health.
And Will is really upset about it.
And I'm just going to say that his book, Lie There and Lose Weight, How I Lost 100 Pounds by Doing Next to Nothing, it's not a diet plan book, it's a memoir, but it's there to be inspirational. It's there to help you find the courage that you need to find what you need and then stick with it.
It's very pragmatic.
It's pragmatic, but he's not just dictating some miracle formula at you. There is no such thing. I think that what's great about this book is that John is sharing what it was that allowed him to find the courage to stay with what worked for him, and hopefully his example will help inspire others to find what works for them.
And the bottom line is, if you find, and this will be my last, I swear, Jim, if you find it very hard to lose weight, it is not because something is wrong with you. It is not because something is wrong with you emotionally. It is not because somehow you have moral lapses, although God knows I have moral lapses. That wasn't one of them.
I don't have to have the morality before
Right. It is the reason it is hard for you to lose weight is because losing weight is hard.
It is. It sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not conditioned for it.
My problem is that I was very, very, very skinny, as John can tell you. And then
I used to be a very long time ago.
About the time I quit smoking, and this is not total coincidence, I gained about 30 pounds.
That is a very common story.
Yeah, and it is.
The replacement of one addiction or need with another.
No, that's really not it.
Change in metabolism?
Yes, that's it.
I see.
Yes, it's also
very common.
Yeah.
And a very difficult thing to combat.
I did not start eating more, anything like that. Your metabolism changes, and how your body metabolizes nutrients. In other words, as long as I was smoking, the cells in my body weren't getting the benefit of a lot of what I was eating. So it would just pass through the
system. There's a reason why so many French philosophers were skinny. They lived on coffee and cigarettes.
Yes, exactly.
And pastry, and that's the trick.
Cheese, pastries, coffee, and cigarettes.
This sounds
wonderful.
I'm
hungry. Son of a
bitch.
Welcome to my world. That's my secret, Captain.
Are you really?
I'm always hungry.
Bitch? See that one can say that's just a word.
No, I think if anything, I would just wait for the musical break, then go down to the pizzeria up the street.
If we had one.
They're open to 4. The one next to the pub.
Huh?
I checked that. Oh, maybe I misread the sign. Maybe they were open until 4 p.m.
Oh. Yeah, something like that. No.
Why would you close a pizzeria at 4 p.m.? That just seems so.
It is pitiful how little food is around here. We're 4 blocks from Junior's, and they close at 11 p.m.
That's a crime.
It really is.
There ought to be a law.
Junior's.
When I am dictator of the land... This shall be forbidden!
You know, the next thing, whoa, Hopples, I shouldn't say that. Now, there was, when BAI was located for a while up in Harlem, and I had to drive there and back, on the way back, I would stop at Whoa Hop at 4 a.m. or something like that, and get takeout. Ah, wonderful, wonderful.
I've actually been dismayed to learn that our favorite 24-hour place in Astoria is going to be sold coming in the spring, the Neptune Diner, which has been operation for 30 years.
Oh, yes, right.
Apparently, the lease is expiring at the end of April. They don't have a renewal option. And the owner of the property, from what I hear, is looking to sell the property for real estate development. Which is a shame. The Neptune Diner has been an institution in Astoria. It's the only place in Astoria that has 24-hour diner food delivery, so that there were times when, you know, I would be working on a novel all night long and would have a craving need for a cheeseburger, onion rings, and a milkshake at 3:15 in the morning, and the Neptune Diner is the only place that would bring it to me.
You're in Astoria. I know it's Sherrington Jackson Heights that will do it.
But I don't know that they'll deliver all the way to me in Astoria.
Not to Astoria.
And that's the really heartbreaking thing, is that my wife and I have loved the Neptune Diner, and to learn that we're going to be losing this wonderful fixture in the neighborhood is just really sad.
Astoria has tons of late night and 24-hour restaurants.
Not 24-hour delivery.
Not delivery.
See, that's the thing. Being able to get a burger delivered at 3:15 in the morning with a milkshake.
I
got spoiled. I used to live in Hell's Kitchen in Manhattan.
Ooh, yeah.
And I had the Westway Diner, which is where I used to live.
Oh, yes.
And I used to get, you know, late night 24-hour delivery from the Westway, and that was my saving grace through much of my 20s and my early 30s.
And bringing this all the way back around to Sheckley, believe it or not, one of my favorite lines from a Robert Sheckley story is, he said, one of the great things about living in Greenwich Village is that you can find a bottle big enough to hold a man at 2 in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah. Although,
yeah,
I always thought of him as an Upper West Sider.
Maybe he just said New York City.
Or he was writing about the village, or maybe before he was with Ziva Quitney. He lived down in the village.
Wait, can you look it up under the word Drast, DRAST?
I missed the village, too. I lived in Greenwich Village during my college years at NYU. And I remember really just...
Yeah, you're an NYU film student.
Yep, I was at NYU film.
So... Why haven't you actually been this
more TV
question.
And film focused?
Yes.
It really comes down to
because I suckered
a simple...
him into the prose world.
No, that's actually far from it. by the time you got your hands on me, I was already ruined. Yep. What happened
not
was
going near that.
It was a simple matter of economics.
Sounds like a Jane Austen thing.
I know, doesn't it? Yeah. No, the really simple answer is it was a matter of economics. I made a couple of unfortunate decisions during the months leading up to my graduation from college. One was that because I'd been injured in a car accident between my junior and senior year and spent most of my senior year of college in physical therapy, learning to walk again, et cetera, and thought that I was going to plan on staying in the city after graduation, I sold my car, or I should say I let my parents sell my car. I had this wonderful little Chevy Chevette. Not much of a car, but it was reliable. It ran. It was a good, solid little machine. I should have kept it. Because if I'd kept it, I could have made the drive from New York to L.A. I maybe could have looked at the posting boards in NYU and found someone else who wanted to go out and make a go of it. But I just wasn't wired that way. And instead, I ended up crashing on someone's floor for 6 weeks and found a roommate. Ended up getting an apartment in New York. Found jobs in publishing, which, because I had been running the College Humor magazine at NYU, was the only thing that I really had professional job skills for was print publishing, specifically magazines, newspapers, journalism, that sort of thing. And so as a result, I wound up graduating from college into the first Bush recession of 91. I was deep in debt, with college debts exceeding close to 50,000. I had credit card debts that had been run up because some scholarships had fallen apart at the last minute, and I'd had to put my last year of tuition on a credit card, so that card got maxed out with interest rates that were through the roof. I had no savings, deep in debt. I literally, at that point, around the age of 22 or 23, could not have afforded the airfare to fly to the West Coast. I never mind move out there. Having let my parents sell my car, I had no physical means of getting there. And remember, this is in the era before the internet. The internet as we now know it did not exist in 1991. There was...
Well, the web did not.
The web did not. I mean, BBSs did, but...
BBSs were not the internet, but there was the internet.
But the internet
has a different thing.
The World Wide Web, the easy-to-use, user-friendly internet experience as we know it today... Yes. Did not exist.
Mosaic browser wasn't there.
It wasn't there.
Yeah.
So the web as we know it didn't exist. GPS as we know it did not exist commercially in an easy to use format in 91.
Well, there
were very expensive formats that were made for nautical use and aeronautical, but not for people driving, for just anybody in their car.
Well, no.
So you didn't have the GPS on your iPhone. iPhones, remember, iPhones didn't exist before what, 2007? I mean, keep this in mind. A lot of things we take for granted over the last...
I'm an anti-Apple person.
You kids don't know how hard we had it.
What I'm saying is, I was in a position where...
And iPhones weren't the first.
So in my early 20s, I was in a position where, you know, moving out to L.A. was financially not viable. I had no cash reserves, no savings, no car. Literally could not afford the airfare. Had no friends in L.A. because everybody I knew in the world lived in New York because I'd gone to NYU.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no contacts. I had no family contacts. My family wasn't in a position financially to sponsor me and send me out there. So,
but in New York, why not look for an agent?
I did, but the problem is most of the agents who are based in New York are literary agents.
Yes.
And I was situated for I was situated for literary work, but that's not where my focus was. I still tried to find the entree into film and TV. I was still sending out spec scripts to Star Trek DS9, Star Trek Next Generation. I was still trying to find a way to get myself to LA, and it just wasn't working out. And then when John and I made those first few sales in quick succession, I thought, well, this is going to be the thing. It's going to open
and
the doors.
And you were lucky because you went direct on that.
We went direct on that. And I thought that this was going to be the sort of thing where, okay, we've made two sales and two phone calls. We'll make a few more and then parlay that into a staff job and make the move west. At that point, with a few sales, I would have enough money, pay off my debts, etc. Well, it didn't work out that way. After those first couple of easy sales, John and I pitched somewhere around 200 ideas over the course of the next...
And sold one more.
And we sold one more. And ironically, that one more we sold was one that we pitched in our first phone call with DS9. It's just one they sat on for 3 years before they finally pulled the trigger. So we pitched hundreds of ideas, leading to no sales. Meanwhile, I was struggling to stay alive by selling freelance articles, working as everything from a crime beat reporter to writing about tech journalism, sports, men's entertainment, whatever it was that would pay the bills. Whoever was buying articles, I was selling articles. And
I was at Ziff Davis in those days.
Right. So I was working
tech journalism. Yeah.
Right. So I ended up working for a lot of publications, computer buyer's guides, stuff like that. I ended up working for professional sports publications who made game day programs. I worked for Labar Friedman, which was a business publisher, doing news publishing. Nation's Restaurant News was my bailiwick because I had a cooking background. I worked my way through high school and college. First as a short order cook and eventually worked my way up to assistant chef. And I was able to parlay that plus publishing skills into working at Nation's Restaurant News for a number of years. And then around 2000, between 97 and 2000, I taught myself World Wide Web programming out of a book. Got into working on the website for Nation's
HTML
Restaurant
News. HTML or
HTML,
actual?
HTML, JavaScript, yeah. Cold Fusion,
oh, doing
PHP.
The actual...
Doing it all by hand.
Yeah.
And parlayed that around 2000. I moved jobs. I left Labar Friedman and became the editor of sci-fi.com, the official website of the Sci-Fi Channel.
I had forgotten that you were editor there. Right.
I was the editor there for 8 years. And
when Ellen Datlow was doing sci fiction, which
yes,
was.
Yes, Ellen Datlow and I had cubicles that we would look over the top and we would talk to each other. And. Ellen Datlow and I were cubicle neighbors, and Scott Edelman, who you probably know.
Who will be on the air in April.
Yes, Scott Edelman is a good friend of mine. I just recorded an episode of his Eating the Fantastic
podcast.
Oh,
did you?
Yes, when I was down in Baltimore a few weeks ago. But Scott and I worked together.
Where did you go?
We went to a Persian restaurant, the Orchard Market Cafe in
Ballmer.
Yeah, outside Ballmer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we had a wonderful meal and a sprawling two-hour conversation where we realized that though we worked together for 8 years, and he started at Sci-Fi just 5 months after I did, we realized how little time we'd actually spent getting to know each other. So we kind of had a great sit-down and get back.
I've known Scott like 30, 35 years, and we've never gotten together for this show. One of the reasons being...
He lives in West Virginia.
But that's besides the point. He's in New York all the bleeping time.
What do you think,
Ben? He was within half a block of my house when he and his wife were doing an anniversary tour, meaning if they were having a major anniversary of, wedding anniversary. And so they went to all their favorite restaurants, and one of them was in my part of Brooklyn.
What do you know? So anyway, so I was working at...
And John's part of Brooklyn, by coincidence.
Indeed, yes. So I was working at Sci-Fi, and
But he's coming here?
To Nursif.
No.
To
Hour of the Wolf.
Hour of the Wolf. Well, that's going to be great.
Well, that's the thing, is that he won't... I mean, I see him at cons. We go out for meals and stuff like that. He doesn't want to record Hour of the Wolf. He only wants to do it live.
Well, that's Scott. Scott is very much a people person, and he likes to have that eye-to-eye contact. He likes to be...
Well, I agree with that, but if we record, it's still eye-to-eye.
But you know what I mean.
Yeah, no. Yeah, but he wants to do, he loves, and I do understand this actually. There is something special about the immediacy of what we are doing right now, live freeform radio.
Sure.
And let me take a moment to pitch what I have to pitch this morning. Aside from the New York Review of Science Fiction reading coming up March 6th with Elisa Quitney and Nick Kaufman here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn Commons. The thing I'd like to pitch over WBAI is, any guesses, John?
Something you're involved with?
WBAI.
WBAI, ah.
Yes, we are in a fund drive. You wouldn't know that from this show. But we are in a fund drive. And what we are begging for this particular time is not... nothing that if you pledge, X hundred dollars or something like that, we'll give you this. that. We're looking for what we call WBAI, or rather just BAI buddies. What that means, instead of Sensibly giving us like $25 for a year, you give us $25 per month, or $10 per month, or actually what have you per month. But you sign up for something per month, which also does make you a full member of WBAI. You get the mailings, you get the right to vote in our elections, Lord help us, and which is for the board. And the way that you do become a BAI buddy is, I think the easiest way is just to go to WBAI.org. And you will see there, I know they've got all these phone numbers and give numeral to WBAI.org. Forget it. Jessica, now I've got a staff member watching on Facebook, so she's going to say, that's not what you're supposed to do. I say, just go to WBAI.org. And there you will see the prompt that says, become a BAI buddy. Yeah, well, do that. Do that, please. Do it now. No. Do it at 3 when the next show starts. That's not
right, because you don't want to miss a moment of this scintillating conversation.
Exactly. But this is actually very important, not only to the survival of the radio station, which is always hanging on a precipice, but also, I mean, you know, our rent for the transmitter room is $65,000 a month and going up every year due to some kind of usurious contract that BAI and Pacifica got itself in.
And we live in an era when government support and municipal support for public radio is at an all-time low.
We're not public radio.
We're not public radio, but for, you know, any type of
radio. No, I mean, we're not public radio.
All right.
WNYC is public radio. They get government money. We are listener-sponsored radio.
So listener-sponsored radio, even more precariously perched. So these guys get nothing. They are completely dependent upon you.
Yeah, we get help from CPB that they pay the music rights.
Right.
And things like that. But we are over 90% listener-sponsored. And when they say on a public station, if you give us $10, such and such will match that, so we'll actually get $30. No, if you give us $10, we get $10. We are beholden to our sponsors, like any radio station is beholden to their sponsors. But the difference is, in this case, our sponsors are you and not a government body or a corporate body. It is amazing how much public radio gets from corporate and public television.
So stop being cheap and cough up the scratch, people. Otherwise, this is all going to go away.
It's very true. We came so close this year.
They're sucking fumes, people. Come on, get with it.
Not just sucking fumes. We just got a $2 million.
They're moving the furniture out as we speak. They're taking away the chairs.
Yeah.
David, are they taking that guy's desk?
Let me tell people, please, because it's not a joke. We came this close to foreclosure in the last 3 months. We had a judgment against us for $1.8 million.
That's not good.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So we have also secured a loan for $2 million, which we don't have to start paying back for 2 years. So we have a little breathing space. So when you're talking about that they're taking the stuff out, this we were 2 months after the judgment against us. That's how close we were. So really, not joking. Not joking. So while the space that we have, the physical plant that we have here at WBAI is not grand, it is at least A, friendly, and B, we have it. We use it. I like it more. You've been at many of our spaces, John. How do you rate this? Were you ever at the church?
I was never at the church because I was like 12. When you were at the church.
I started working for BAI when I was 13.
Well,
so
somebody had to stay home and listen to you.
I was just trying to guilt people into giving money, man.
Yeah.
Of all the places that I've come and been on your show, this is certainly the most convenient because it's close to my house.
It's convenient, but I like the atmosphere here. I like the feeling of the place. It's number two next to the church.
And it's part of a whole thriving community here, and that's a very important aspect to it instead of being isolated.
But one more time, let me just tell people.
This place is number two.
Become BAI Buddy by going to WBAI.org and signing up for it. Because what David was saying, the reason I stopped him is because it's not a joke. We've really been living this. And you have no idea just how, not only how close we came to that, but there are people within the station still advocating going Chapter 11 and stuff like that and being taken over by people who've been trying to take us over since the beginning of this century and merging into them. This is something I'm totally against, and I'm not going to get into the BAI politics of that. But this is something that is still an ongoing thing. And the only way that we can stave off that stuff is by being independent and raising enough money as a listener-sponsored radio station by your donations. So please go to WBAI.org, either become a WBAI buddy or give an outright donation. And don't forget, when it asks you, what is your favorite radio show? Well, it's Hour of the Wolf, which you're listening to. My name is Jim Freund. With me, David Mack and John Ordover.
We're here to remind you that you don't actually need that second kidney, so why not sell it?
Yes, exactly.
Make a donation to WBA.
Exactly, yes. And John has a book.
It's called...
It's not on camera anymore.
It isn't.
It actually is. Yeah, it is. The problem is that the Facebook text
it's
is
It's called
there.
Lie There and Lose
Oh,
Weight.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Ben just gave us money.
Lie There and Lose Weight. How I Lost 100 Pounds by Doing Next to Nothing. And it's basically...
And the publisher is?
Oh, and the publisher is Wilder Publications.
And David's new book is The Midnight Front.
Book one of the Dark Art series, which is from Tor Books. Book two, The Iron Codex, is already written. It is in editing and, with any luck, will be out this time next year in 2019. The third book, The Shadow Commission... I'm working on the story right now, and if all goes well, that should be out in January 2020.
Yeah.
And both our books are available at any fine bookseller,
all
real
of your
or
favorite
imaginary.
Retailers.
Yeah, all of your favorite booksellers.
Although the easiest way to get David's books...
You could go to my website, davidmack.pro. You'll find The Midnight Front right on the front page, along with buy links to your favorite retailers in all four of its current release formats.
Dot Pro. You actually got a top-level domain on Pro?
I did, because I was a member of the Writers Guild, which has very strict credentials for membership.
I'm a member of the Writers Guild.
Then you should get yourself a .pro domain.
Why?
Why not? I did it because I couldn't get a .com domain. But if I could just finish this pitch real quick, basically you can get The Midnight Front in hardcover. You can get it in trade paperback, ebook, or digital audio. We released all four formats simultaneously so that if you're a purist and you like hardcover, you can get it that way. If you don't have the money to drop on a hardcover and would rather have trade paperback, the more affordable format is available right on the same day. If you are an ebook enthusiast or just maybe a little more economical, ebooks available. And if you're the kind of person that likes to listen to your stories, the digital audiobook dropped on the same day. It's available on both.
I assume that came out through Macmillan Audio.
Macmillan Digital Audio, and I believe it's also distributed through a number of fine digital audio retailers of various types and stripes.
Yeah.
While my book is.
I produce audiobooks. So.
My website is liethereloseweight.com, and the book is available in hardcover and trade paperback. And ebook.
Let's get back. I was just trying to mention the titles and move on.
I just want people to know that
you threw meat in front of the dogs here.
Yes. I mean, we released in four formats, which was a very bold move on the part of the publisher, and I just wanted to thank them for showing that level.
No, that's fine, but I just didn't want to get into the whole...
Neepery.
Yeah. Yeah, we've already, you know...
Sorry, down the rabbit hole, and we're back again.
Yeah. And we're repeating titles, yes. And Ben, by the way, let me mention, Capclave has changed its week. It's the last week of September this year.
That's
Hope
very
to
exciting.
See you then. Well, once somebody is there, and it's extremely relevant because if that person weren't in D.C., mm-hmm. or near D.C. during Half-Clave, I might not go.
Oh, that's a good
And then
point.
While that person is here on Facebook, I just found this out, going there. By the way, if anybody's going to Heliosphere, they're having their second con this year, I will be very present, as will Barbara Krasnov, my partner. And I will be doing Guest of Honor interview with Charles Gannon, Chuck Gannon, and Eric Flint, who are the two guests of honor. And a lot of fun. Hildy Silverman is also doing a lot
good
of
friend
stuff
of mine.
There. Yeah, she's wonderful. She's wonderful. Thank God for Hildy Silverman.
Yes.
Okay, for anybody who doesn't know, her husband,
David Silverman.
David Silverman is the head of American Atheists. And what I used to actually have to engineer Margaret Murray O'Hare, the founder of that. That was a nasty organization before David got involved. Mm. And now it's a very good one.
And also, since you brought up Hildy Silverman, she lost 30 pounds in part due to the advice that I laid out in my book.
Did she?
She did.
Yeah.
She did, and she reversed oncoming diabetes that way.
I have accomplished nothing so noteworthy with my book.
Yeah, well, I've already got diabetes, so type 2. But again, smoking, quitting smoking. Hmm. They don't tell you these things.
Why would they?
Yeah, and here's the bad part. I had diabetes, and I wasn't diagnosed with it for about 8 years.
Wow, that's not
good. They took the blood. They just never did the sugar. I can't believe it.
Oh, yeah.
From a doctor who then...
I think sometimes you have to ask for that particular test.
I usually trust my doctor to know that they should ask for that test.
More the fool you.
Yeah, and of course, he ended up... This is sad. He ended up dying of similar diseases and stuff, so...
That's terrible.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. By the way, the Nebula Award nominations came out.
I saw that.
And many, many good friends of Hour of the Wolf, and some of mine.
Including Matthew Kressel.
And, let me just go down. Amber Lowe, Lara Donnelly, who was on the show and did in Yursif this year, Dora Goss, Daryl Gregg. These are just the novels. Two people out of the six nominees, two have not been on the show in the last 2 years. Let's put it that way. So that I can make the cavelling easy. Sarah Pinsker, who was at the Yursif reading 2 months ago, she was nominated twice. Lawrence Shern, who was on the show, I guess, about a year ago. When did Barsk come out, John?
Barsk actually, I believe, came out right at the end of December in 2015.
Yeah, okay.
It was released just in time for the eligibility on the following year's ballot.
And that's when he was on the show.
Yes, I remember Lawrence was very excited about that. I loved Barsk. It was a wonderful book.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to Moons of Barsk, the sequel, coming very soon.
Ooh,
a couple dates back, I actually I taught Lawrence in a writer's workshop in Kansas.
Hmm.
And at that point, I got in the habit of describing him as an anthropomorphic yak. But I've sworn I'll never do that again, so I'm not doing it now.
Yeah, good idea. Blah, blah, blah. Let's see. That's novella. Then under novelette, Rick Bowes, one of our favorite guests here and our most frequent guest, certainly on Hour of the Wolf.
Excellent writer, Rick Bowes.
Nominated for his story, Dirty Old Town, which he read on this show. Sarah Pinsker again, Kelly Robeson, who read just last night at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series, curated by Ellen, produced, they don't use the word curated, I do, produced by Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel. K.M. Sbarra, Kellen Sbarra.
Yes, I know Kellen.
Yeah, he is a wonderful person. Has a story for Best Novelette. Short story, usually my favorite category. Fran Wild, Matt Kressel, Carolyn Yakin on Beneath Ceaseless Skies. Movies, Get Out, The Good Place, an episode. Michael's Gambit. Yeah, that's. I like the trolley problem, but hey. But Michael's Gambit was okay. Logan, The Shape of Water, Star Wars, Last Jedi, and Wonder Woman. Which would you each vote for in that
In the dramatic presentation category?
Yeah.
My heart goes to Logan.
Okay. John?
I'm lean more toward The Good Place, because I have some difficulties with Logan that have to do with my personal life, and I'll tell you another time, but I'd go with The Good Place.
Okay, I love The Good Place.
I love The Good Place. I enjoy it very much. I like that it's taking philosophy and finding humor in it and also being intellectual without being alienating. But in terms of the overall artistic achievement, I just feel that Logan achieves so much with those characters. And I think that for director James Mangold, the fact that he brought his sensibility as a director of Westerns and his particular vision of the American Southwest.
And this is his second Wolverine movie.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at his work on like 310 to Yuma, where he had this very beautiful sense of the bleak potential of the American Southwest and that landscape and that color palette, and he brought that so effectively to Logan. I feel that cinematically it's a remarkable achievement, and in terms of the screenplay, how it ties together so much of the mythos and makes you rethink the relationship between Logan and Xavier, Xavier's relationship with himself and his own powers, and then the fact that you have Logan confronting his relationship with Laura and what does that mean for him. I just feel that there was a lot there that was emotionally resonant, that felt emotionally true. And I just feel that for the impact that it had as a work of cinema, I found it to be one of the most moving works of the year. And as much as I love The Good Place, I just feel that it shouldn't even be
in
the
same category.
They shouldn't be in the same category. There should be a short form category
and
a long form cinematic category. And the problem is they're putting up a sitcom episode up against an amazing cinematic achievement, and I just don't think it's a fair comparison.
With the Hugo Awards, with the Hugo Awards, they put radio dramas and albums against movies.
They did.
But yes, and first of all, they've sort of gotten rid of the radio drama category. Now they have Best Fan Cast. This show isn't even eligible because this isn't a podcast, even though it's available through an RSS feed and all that. But this is radio. So this isn't a fan cast, technically, even though I'm not paid. This is pro. Because this is broadcast around the world and stuff like that. It's actually broadcast. So it's not eligible for Hugo. I've been through all of this.
If we want to get into sort of trading bitter dregs regarding the Hugo, you're talking to a media tie-in writer.
Okay, yeah, exactly. But let me get back to what I was going to say, which is that the Firesign Theater, who did some of the best audio drama this side of the ocean, because on the other side there was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, on this side, Hitchhiker's was not eligible, or rather would go up against movies. And the Firesign Theaters, I think we're all bozos on this bus, which is a brilliant piece of science fiction audio work, lost to something called Clockwork Orange. Why? I don't know. and their album before that, Don't Crush a Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers, again, lost to that same stupid director for something called 2001. I just don't get it.
As long as we're talking...
But I'm also against the Nebulas, let me just say. The Ray Bradbury Award, so-called.
Because it doesn't differentiate media.
Because the Nebulas are about writing. It's the science fiction writers of America. And it used to be the best screenplay, and now it's best dramatic presentation, and I think that it should go back to being for screenplay, since these are supposed to be the writers. The writers who are nominated.
I can see your argument for that.
Yeah, and by the way, my nominee that I will be voting for is The Shape of Water.
I've heard it's an excellent film. I haven't seen it.
See it. I'm not always a Del Toro fan. I am of this film.
As long as we're talking about awards, I'd like to mention that my friend Jack Greenspan, who is listening in right now in Lithuania, where he teaches at a university, and he's also a writer, just got the Best Foreign Professor Award from his students at the university he teaches at in Lithuania, and that I promised him I would do my best to find a way to mention his name on this show since he's listening in Lithuania.
Oh, now Lauren Strone is watching us on Facebook.
Artfully
your,
done there,
your ears were buzzing, weren't they? Oh, and let me just mention the last...
I assure you, Lawrence, we spoke only praise.
And let me just mention the last category, which is the Andre Norton Award for YA science fiction or fantasy. Our good friend Sam J. Miller was nominated for The Art of Starving.
So, yes. Who else was nominated in that category?
People I don't know, who I probably should. EXO, written by Fonda Lee. Weave a Circle Round by Kerry Marin, M-A-A-R-E-N, from Tor Books. And Want by Cindy Pan, who actually I did interview for this show.
Okay.
Some years ago for a non-YA book.
Who wrote The Art of Starving? Because it occurs to me...
Sam Miller.
Maybe I can get a quote from my book.
No.
Good luck with that.
You shameless whore.
I understand. It was a joke.
Yeah.
You're still a shameless whore.
Yes. And we did some of our best work together, Dave.
At any rate, I just want
to...
At any rate, I can turn down everybody's mics. I control the vertical and the horizontal. And the left channel and the right channel. But BAI, we don't have a right channel. At any rate... I just wanted to congratulate all the nominees, especially so more than half of them are people I know and have worked with even in the last 2 years. So I took a look at the list of people here and thought the genre is doing well.
Indeed.
And that's really the statement that I wanted to make. It's alive and well. And doing good stuff. Somebody asked, is there any kind of... Oh, now Lawrence has the flu, which is why he's listening. Is there any kind of an award for tie-in work?
There is the International Association of Media Tie-in Writers, which annually gives out the Scribe Award, which recognizes excellence in the field of media tie-in writing. There are four or five categories. I can't remember right now. I believe there is Best Original Novel, General Category, which is that to say non-speculative fiction. So those are tie-in novels based on things like detective series, anything that would be non-SF, non-fantasy. Then there's Best Original Novel in the Speculative Fiction category. Best Adapted Novel, General. Best Adapted Novel, Speculative. And I believe they have a fifth category. I don't remember if it's graphic novels or if they have one for audio drama at this point. I've won one Scribe Award over the years for my 24 novel, Rogue. I've been nominated 5 times. My friend Keith DeCandido has been nominated several times. He's never won the actual Scribe Award, but he has been honored with the Grandmaster Award.
Did Greg Keith Cox DeCandido. Ever get nominated? Or?
Greg Cox has received numerous nominations. I don't recall if Greg has won.
He'll know.
If Greg is listening, and if you happen to want to jump in and tell us whether you ever won a Scribe, please do. I don't mean to slight you. I actually just honestly don't remember at this particular moment whether Greg has taken home a Scribe Award.
I recall him telling a story. He may have, because I recall him telling a story that he'd been busy, and this may be correct or not, he won the award, but nobody bothered to tell him.
That's a shame. I know also many years back...
Greg has gotten two.
Oh, very good. So okay. Greg has won 2 Scribes. That's entirely appropriate. I'm surprised he actually hasn't won more. A number of years before that, there was a website called unrealitysf.com.
Oh, I remember that.
Which did fan-based awards. They were more like the Yugos. They were sort of like the Yugo version of a media tie-in award to the IAMTW's Scribe Award, which is more like the Nebulous. Yeah. It's a juried award.
We should explain to listeners that
the Scribe Award is a juried award. There's a panel of five jury members or so.
The Nebulous are not juried. It's a
membership voting.
It's a peer award.
Peer award versus jury on the Scribe Award.
And it's juried on the World Fantasy Award.
Right. And then the Unreality SF site
was a fan-based award with very broad-based voting. And I won one of those for my Star Trek novel, Rise Like Lions, I believe, in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So, but
still, I'm a little puzzled by, with all the tie-in work that you and your peers and people we've been naming, like Keith and Greg and so on and so forth, I am croggled as to why more of your work has not been adapted, because you're taking properties that exist, franchises that are there. You are writing new adventures, new stories, things that would work into their universes, and therefore would be, I think, would have a built-in audience already for doing long-form television or cinema or different or audio drama?
You would think, but here's the sad reality, is that the average readership of, let's say, a media tie-in novel for Star Trek or Star Wars represents only about 1% to 2% of the total audience for that property. As a result, the people who run the TV shows and the movies, the parent properties on which the media tie-ins are based, they don't want to limit themselves by trying to adapt material that has only been exposed to maybe 1% or 2% of their audience. And there's also another factor to consider, which is look at it from the point of view of a television writer. If you have an opportunity to put your mark on something like Star Trek, you're going to want to have the created by credit. You're going to want to develop an idea that's yours, that you can take credit for, that you have the created by credit on, because that represents not only credit, but also money. If you have the created by credit, you get paid for every episode of a show that bears that credit. You get a piece of the licensing, depending on your contract. But if you're basing that on a piece of literary material created by somebody else, even if it's work for hire, you already own it, you still have, under the Writers Guild, an obligation to acknowledge the source of it, in which case you're no longer getting the created by credit, now you're getting the developed by credit, which carries some privileges, but not all the privileges. And even if you're not paying the writer of the original material, you still have to acknowledge them, and that diminishes the value of the perceived value of the credit on the part of the TV creator.
See, of all the various X-Men films, and there are now, what, 13 or 14?
There have been several, yes.
And
they've done some excellent adaptations, like Days of Future Past.
Eight or more are based on works by Chris Claremont.
Sure.
He gets zero credit.
That's right, zero. Because it probably was not covered under his contract at the time, and he's only entitled to get what was
covered. He was staff.
So it was covered as work for hire. It was work product as an employee.
Yeah.
Which is really unfortunate.
The first place where I've seen his credit on any X-Men-related material is the TV series Legion.
Which is excellent, by the
way. Isn't it?
It is a superb show. Very well made, very stylish, great casting, great acting. I love Aubrey Plaza.
Oh, my God.
She is so good in that. She steals the whole thing. I mean, I thought she was excellent on Parks and Rec, but to see her cut loose and just own every scene that she is in Legion is just remarkable. She is one of the most impressive performers out there.
Another consideration for the why they don't adapt any of the tie-in novels is that novels don't require budgeting.
Oh yeah, we tend to do things. We tend to do things that are not economically feasible to film,
because that's the whole point, kind of.
Oh, and there's another issue too, which is that the story concept
that the two of you wrote. John once said to me that one of the ways to help it sell was the fact that it didn't require many sets. It was sort of a submarine story.
Bottle shows is what they call it. Back in the 90s, freelancers were still able to pitch to TV shows, and before TV shows were mostly written by in-house staff writers, freelancers would learn to pitch bottle shows, which use only standing sets and minimal effects. They would cost very little to make. They would be mostly dialogue and character-driven. And as a result, the show would save money on that episode, which could then be turned and repurposed for the more expensive episodes written by the show's in-house producers. And learning to write bottle shows for any show was a key talent back in the 90s. These days, where most shows have shorter episodic runs of 13 to 15 episodes and tend to be strictly controlled in-house by the writer's room, freelancers don't really get to pitch anymore, and the art of the bottle show has mostly gone away. But another issue that prevents the effective adaptation of many novels, let's say, from going to television or film, is that the amount of narrative content in a novel far exceeds what you can do in most feature films. Most feature films have the narrative content of about a novelette or a novella, maybe a short novella. And that's just because of the limitations. You have maybe 25 to 30 story beats in a screenplay for a feature film, but you can have anywhere from 80 to 100 story beats.
I'm sorry, would you explain a story beat?
A story beat might be an individual scene or a dramatic unit of story in which a specific narrative goal is moved forward or a specific narrative fact is
established. I love that term. I've never heard that before. Okay.
It's a very much a Hollywood term, the story beat.
Yeah.
And so there are 25 to 30 major story beats in most feature films. You can break down most feature films, even if they have lots of little breakaways and cutaways. There's really only 25 to 30 major story narrative setups that occur over the course of a 90-minute to two-hour film. Whereas if you were to go into the average feature-length novel, full-length novel of, say, 80,000 to 120,000 words, you might find anywhere from 65 to 100 story beats or even more. Individual scenes, specific dramatic setups that would need to be represented. That's why, for instance, novels are more in line with, say, a full season of an episode of television. That's why you can take, like, a full novel of, say, George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire and get a whole season out of it.
Funny you should say that, because one of our Facebook listeners is just commenting on just that.
And that's pretty much right. I mean, essentially, the amount of narrative content that you can pack into a well-constructed novel in order to unpack it effectively would take anywhere from 12 to 15 episodes, 12 to 15 hours of episodic television.
And George, for those who don't know, had a long history of working in television,
and he understood
long
this.
Before
well,
Ice
he was actually
Fire.
Famously quoted as saying when A Song of Ice and Fire was first seeing publication that he didn't think it was ever going to be adaptable to television because he thought there are too many characters, there are too many plot lines, it's too complex. What changed between then and now was the evolution of the long form television format.
Yes,
with the rise of Hill Street Blues back in the 80s, and then
Steve
the shows
Botch
that followed.
Goes, well, Saint Elsewhere.
But essentially, what changed with Hill Street Blues was the introduction to the American audience, especially, of long-form serialized storytelling.
With more characters.
With more characters in a primetime format.
Basically soap operas with just enough action that men would watch too.
Precisely. It was soap operas for men, let's say. Hmm. And with the with the audience accepting the rise of the long-form narrative structure in primetime television, that opened the door to adapting more complex works, literary works, into television. So although, for instance, let's say some of the more famous Star Trek novels, like, for instance, Imzadi by Peter David, which is a remarkable novel in its own right. It works beautifully as a novel. It was actually the novel that, back when John was first trying to persuade me to take up prose writing and pitch him some books for Star Trek, I was not sure I wanted to do it until he handed me a copy of Peter David's Imzadi, and I read it and I went, holy crap. You mean to tell me a tie-in novel can be like this? It can do things like this? This is amazing. And once I saw the potential in the form, I knew I had to get in on it and I had to start doing it. Imzadi would make a lovely event series for Star Trek. You could get 6-8 episodes out of that easily. But here's the caveat. You'd start with the novel, and it's got this beautifully, intricately constructed story. Nobody in Hollywood is just going to take that, map that on to 6 or 8 episodes and shoot it. They'll never do it. Because the first rule of Hollywood is the chefs always like the taste of the soup better after they urinate in it. And nobody wants to be the guy.
But isn't that somewhat changing with long-form TV now?
Nope. Essentially, I mean, look at one of the most successful film adaptations from comic books, which was X-Men Days of Future Past. That's a fantastic movie. It works so well on so many levels. But It bears almost no actual content similarity to the two-issue Days of Future Past 1980s comic book on which it was based. The original comic books featured Kitty Pryde. It was very talky.
Well, that also had to do with the actors that they had available and who they wanted.
Well, who they also thought was marketable. They didn't want to try and build a new story and establish Kitty Pryde and make her the star. They wanted to cash in on the fact that audiences wanted to see Xavier. They wanted to see Jackman.
There is a Kitty Pryde movie.
There is a Kitty Pryde movie coming now.
Yes.
But at the time, but when they were trying to finance Days of Future Past, they were saying, well, the audiences want to see Jackman as Wolverine. Yeah. They want to see Stewart and McKellen return in their iconic roles. They like Fassbender and McAvoy in the younger version of those roles. It was intended to be a sequel, of course, to First Class.
Right.
And as a result of that, they completely reworked the whole story. They actually threw out most of the narrative content and kept only the most essential element, like the most essential ingredients of the original comic book. But as a result, because they got to the heart of what was it that worked at the very heart of the original, they were able to say, okay, now take that element and retell that story using these characters. And they told a brilliant story with Wolverine and the younger versions of Xavier and Magneto, etc.
Why didn't Quicksilver get on the plane with them?
I guess he had other places to be. Or he thought he could get there faster.
Because he got killed off in a Disney movie.
Because he actually already went there and was bored.
Yeah. But the form that is totally fascinating me and how they're screwing with original material, mm-hmm. and we were talking about this when before we arrived at the radio station, sure. is the taking novels mm-hmm. and putting them into long-form television. The Culture series by Ian Banks just been bought by Amazon for that format. Yes, and that's going to be very interesting. Yeah. I'm fascinated by what they have been doing, for example, with American Gods, which is and is not the book.
It's peculiar in that they're dragging out that first season where they barely scratched like the first third of the book.
That's right.
Whereas in the span of 10 episodes, Netflix was able to do all of Richard K. Morgan's Altered Carbon.
Yes.
Have you seen Altered Carbon?
Not yet.
It is fantastic.
But I will be playing the interview that I did with Richard when the book came out.
Well, I have to say, I must admit that I have not read the original novel, but the adaptation that they did had me captivated. I was enthralled. I thought they did a marvelous job.
It's in my queue. Right now, I'm looking for the time to get to the movies that I've missed while I had the flu.
It's like Neuromancer meets Blade Runner meets who knows what. It's just brilliant.
Speaking of which, Black Panther is pure science fiction.
If I can ever finish
not with us
naming
here.
The shows that I was going to name that are novels being adapted in so many ways and how they're twisting them. I mean, if somebody told me 10 years ago that they were going to do a TV version of The Man in the High Castle, I would have gone, no, it's excellent. And what makes it excellent is the fact that they are not doing the novel. Now, when Ridley Scott made Blade Runner, he's of course had nothing to do
with Android's Dream of Electric Sheep.
Exactly, but
and they actually bought the title from Blade Runner from another novel that the movie has even less to do with Alan E. Norse.
By Alan E. Norse, correct. And there's a William Burroughs tie-in as well.
Of course,
but But that was a misinterpretation of Philip K. Dick's story, and I'm not going to go into that whole argument now, but trust me, I've done 40 hours of radio dissecting Blade Runner, and maybe six on
I did five Blade NYU 20... film school thesis papers on Blade Runner.
I'm talking radio with writers and stuff like, sure. with the people who made the movie, okay? So anyway...
I'm just saying, I'm a Blade Runner.
Boys, you're both pretty.
Okay, I'm talking about The Man in the High Castle, not Blade Runner.
You were talking about Blade Runner just
then. I'm talking about the long form. We have 2 minutes left of this radio show, so.
Well, I'm really glad I got to pimp this book.
What book would that be, Dave?
Midnight Front, book one of my Dark Knight series.
Your mics are now off. I'm serious. Okay? When I say that I'm conducting the show, I'm conducting it. I know that we're freeform, but when I am trying to steer things a certain way, it's because I've been doing this for almost 50 years now. So, and there are points I have to hit, and including finding out who's on the air next, if somebody's on the air next, and I still didn't get to ask the question that I've been trying to ask, and I won't be able to now. It's too bad, because you're the perfect people to ask it about, which is this new long form of TV in taking novels and all that, and how perfect I think something like The Midnight Front, published by Tor Books, and is the beginning of a series, or for that matter, American Craftsman by Tom Doyle, or not John's book on Lie There and Lose Weight. That would not make a very good TV. I'll watch, you know, the workout shows instead. No, not Richard Simmons. But don't you think that that would make a good long-form TV work?
Yes. In fact, I crafted it especially to be adaptable. That was part of the entire plan from the very beginning.
Yes. And Lawrence Stern, by the way, says, "This is radio, Dave. Don't just hold up the book and say the damn title." But I did that for you. So, again, from Tor Books, The Midnight Front by David Mack, not to be confused with the comic book artist, which we didn't even get to discuss.
It's a whole other show.
It is, and we should do that show. And John will be back on the air, no doubt, talking about it's not a diet book. It's a, you know, really lose weight book.
It's a memoir.
Actually, it is a memoir.
It's a memoir, and it's basically a companion to all the diet books you already have. You don't need another miracle diet plan. You need to know how to stick to whatever works for you.
Yeah, and of course, my belief is there is no such thing as a miracle
That's correct.
Diet plan. And that does tie in to John's book very well.
Which I'm looking to adapt into a graphic novel.
Now, and I thought it was going to be long-form TV, but, you know, what do I know? At any rate, I really don't know what's on the air next. I know that Lister is sick and that he will not be here to do his striptease, which he normally does near the end of our Facebook Live. I am hoping that Habte Selassie will be here. If not, I've made arrangements through Max Schmid for some recorded programming. I would like to remind everybody that this is a fundraising drive. Our survival depends on your going to WBAI.org and donating some money, preferably in the name of this show, and that the genre exists on your supporting people like those who have been here. It's way too long, David, since I've actually had you here either live or on recording. You did the Star Trek thing for the New York Review of Science Fiction readings.
Oh, yes, last year.
Yes, but that's actually, I run that separate of this radio program, even though it's in the same building. Yes. I thank you, John Ordover and David Mack. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I hope I won't be back in just a few minutes saying I don't know what the bleep is going on the air, but it will be something or other. Please, everybody, take good care of yourselves. Be good to each other. This is, you know, the normal outro, but it applies over and over again. And, let me throw in another one. Be literate. Read. Thank you all for listening. Thank you on Facebook for watching. And again, thank you, John Ordover and David Mack.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Jim.
Have a good morning. See you. WBAI, New York.
The grateful dead.
Interrupting all programs.
I hear the voices in my head. I swear to God, it sounds like they're snoring.
We are controlling the transmission.
Your mind is totally controlled.
And your mind is moving
forward. The pleasures of the journey to the center of the mind.
99, and I hear you.
Well, I am talking about your 50,000 watt intensive care unit, babies.
Just telling on the world.
New York, just like our picture.
City at night.
Woo! Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Pacifica Radio in New York City presents The Morning Dew Show. Concerts, rarities, and tasty tidbits from the greatest era of music ever. The Morning Dew Show, only at 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.
I wanna say to my sisters and my brothers, keep the faith when the storm flies and the wind blows. Go on at a steady pace when the battle is fought and the victory is won. We can all shout together, we have overcome. And we talk to the Father and the Son when we make it to the promised land. If we walk together, little children, we don't ever have to worry. Through this world of trouble, we gotta love one another. Let us take a fellow man by the hand, try to help him to understand. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land. Our Bible reads, thou shalt not be afraid of the terror by night, nor the arrow that flies by day. No, for the pestilence that walketh in the darkness, nor for the destruction that waiteth in the noonday hour. If we walk together, little children, we don't ever have to worry. Through this world of trouble, we got to love one another. Let us take our fellow man by the hand and try to help him to understand. We can all be together forever and ever when we make it to the promised land. Traveling through this land, and we can all be together, shaking a hand when we make it to the promised land. Children, when we make it to the promised land, make it to the promised land, make it to the promised land.
People,
make it to the promised land when we make it to the promised land. Make it to the promised land. We can all be together forever and ever when
beautiful memories it must be for our guest in studio here on Morning Dew and WBAI 99.5 on your dial, streaming globally at WBAI.org. We got the Morning Dew crew here. We got me, Bob O'Donnell.
I'm Stu Robbins.
And Don Grossinger here with you.
And that was just a beautiful track from a new release of Garcia Live, Volume 10, May 20th, 1990, with the Jerry Garcia Band, with Sisters and Brothers, a lovely anthemic song it became. And Melvin, I'll bet you have some fond memories of that. Melvin Seals on the phone with us.
How you guys doing?
Excellent. How are you, sir?
We're fine. We're glad to be with you.
This is thank you for this honor to be able to do this.
It's our honor to speak to you, Melvin. We're big fans all for many years, and also have had the wonderful opportunity to meet you a few times, and it's always a pleasure.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Do you remember that Hawaii show?
I do remember the Hawaii show. We did three performances over there in that period of time. I don't know what show this is, but I remember the period of time that we went over.
Must have been a joy to bring the whole band down there, huh?
Well, it was. I don't think some of the folks had never been to Hawaii before, so and never left to perform there. So I remember we had three great shows out of that. And it was just something to remember. I didn't know the album was out.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know the release date, but I was just given it by the publicity people for the record company that's releasing this. And it's a brandy new release. Just came out on Garcia Live, Volume 10, May 20th, 1990, from Hilo, Hawaii.
Yes. yeah. Oh, it must be a really nice one there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful recording, beautiful soundboard quality, yep.
Right, on this tour, was this when Jerry took up scuba diving?
Well, he had been doing it, but he took us over there. You know, Jerry liked to go to Hawaii just to kind of chill out and relax his mind and calm down before he goes back out on tour. So he would always go to Kona, I think is where he liked to go scuba diving. So he took us over there for three shows, but what it really was a vacation for us. You know, we just did three shows to help pay for it, but we were over there, I think, 7 days. And, you know, I didn't go scuba diving, but I watched Jerry go down. It's quite a sight to see.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've enjoyed photos of him amongst the sea life and other scuba divers where he's just somehow in his element. You know, he seemed at peace in that beautiful surroundings.
He owned it. he was very smooth with all of that, boy. I couldn't do it because I was always paranoid if I thought of something funny and had to laugh. I'd be in trouble. Can you imagine just thinking of something really stupid and you have to laugh and you're underwater?
Hey, that breathing apparatus can be tricky down there.
Tell me about it.
You know? So, well, listen, we're pleased to be able to speak to Melvin Seals, and I'm sure Don has a good list of questions, as do I and Stu. And I want to make note that you have some dates with the JGB, Melvin Seals and JGB touring in the Cats Under the Stars tribute, which is, what, the 40th or anniversary of Cats Under the Stars? Is that correct?
That's what they tell me, yeah.
Yeah. Jerry's favorite album that he worked on in his solo career, right, Don?
Yep, it was his all-time favorite. It's his baby.
And you guys will be at the Stone Pony on March the 1st and at the Capitol Theater in Port Chester, New York on March the 2nd, if I'm not mistaken.
And March the 2nd, we will be recreating that whole album.
Is that the only time you're going to do that?
Well, that was requested by the promoter of the Capitol Theater. And so we are working diligently and hard. There's a couple songs on there that's a little peculiar, if you know the album.
Mm-hmm.
And we're working on that. But we were asked to recreate that as a tribute of the 40th year, you know. So it might be the only time. I'm not quite so sure. If it come off really well, we might do it again.
It's a lovely idea. It is a favorite album of mine, for sure, in Jerry's catalog. And to see it at the beautiful Capitol, I know you've played there plenty of times before. That's going to be in the main room of the Capitol, correct?
Yes, in the main room.
Okay.
We're going to have major competition tonight, as you probably know, but we're going to do our thing.
With that group with the Rhythm Devils in it?
No, I think Phil and Bob Ware is going to be in New York at the same time.
Oh, okay. I missed that one. Right. You're correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, you have a lot of fans and you have a lot of locals up in the Westchester area who would rather go local, too. So, yeah. No.
Well, that's what they tell me. So I'm going to count on that.
Also, the song selection on this album is so great that I think there's plenty of room in the Deadhead world to accommodate both you guys, Bobby and Phil.
Well, it's to your advantage that the Bobby and Phil are doing two nights, and you have the one night there, so people can go to both shows if they wish.
Yes, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
And I'm assuming Bobby and Phil's show is going to sell out so fast, and then the other people are looking for a place to go, and there we are, you know.
There you are, indeed. Yeah. So I was just thinking when we were talking about Sisters and Brothers that it sounds to me like it comes out of the church, and I figure that your background sort of comes from that same direction.
That is correct. I think My Brothers and My Sister is a church song designed to be one, and I came out of the church when I got with the Garcia Band, and you know, there's quite a few songs that he actually did that were, you know, church. They came out of church. That were church songs. The Maker and Waiting for a Miracle, Sisters and Brothers, I Hope We Won't Be This Way Always, Mighty High. There's quite a few of them, you know.
Did he know them before, or did you teach them to him?
No. Well, some of them got developed. I think, you know, one of the girls might say, Jerry wants you to hear the song, and he would hear it, and bam, we're doing it right away. I remember Gloria brought The Maker. Yeah, I remember the day we had a rehearsal. She said, Jerry wants you to hear something. And she played The Maker, and we were doing The Maker from that point on, you know. But the nice thing about it is that the fans always said coming to see the Garcia Band was like their church. It was like going to church. You know,
no question.
That's what I've always heard. So, you know, whether it was not necessarily a church song or not, we gave it that spinoff to it.
Yep.
That gospel feel, and I can verify that from my perspective, because